Welcome to the Grace Community Church Sermons Podcast. Each week we share the sermon from this last week's service. We hope this sermon encourages and equips you on your journey to know and follow Jesus Christ. Let's listen in now. This week we get to hear John Wood give his testimony. This was a very moving time, and I hope that you enjoy the message that he's going to bring. Let's tune in now as we begin to hear what he has to tell us about God did in his life 48 years ago.
From the hands it came down, from the side it came down. From the feet it came down and ran to the ground. Between heaven and hell, a teardrop fell. In the deep crimson dew, the tree of life grew. And the blood gave life to the branches of the tree, and the blood was the price that set the captives free. And the numbers that came through the fire and the flood clung to the tree and were redeemed by the blood. From the tree streamed the light that started the fight. Around the tree grew a vine on whose fruit I could dine. My old friend Lucifer came, fought to keep me in chains, but I saw through the tricks of 666. And the blood gave life to the branches of the tree, and the blood was the price that set the captives free. And the numbers that came through the fire and the flood clung to the tree and were redeemed by the blood. From his hands it came down, from his side it came down, from his feet it came down and ran to the ground. And a small inner voice said, you do have a choice. And the vine engrafted me, and I clung to the tree. And the blood gave life to the branches of the tree, and the blood was the price that set the captives free. And with the numbers that came through the fire and the flood, I clung to the tree and was redeemed by the blood. And the blood gave life to the branches of the tree, and the blood was the price that set the captives free. And with the numbers that came through the fire and the flood, I clung to the tree and was redeemed by the blood. From his hands it came down, from his side it came down, from his feet it came down and ran to the ground. Morning. All right, enough of the peanut gallery. I want to talk to you today about a tree. A little background, a little introduction. I was raised in a Christian home. Both parents were saved. They were raising three boys in the 60s, rough time. We went to church occasionally. The town we grew up was massively liberal, and the apostasy in the churches in the town was, we had churches that denied Christ. So when I was about 13, we were attending a small Baptist church outside of town, and they had a tent revival meeting from the old days. They brought up a preacher from down south, and we had a hellfire and brimstone week. And at the end of that week, I could see the flames of hell when he was done with me. And so I accepted Christ at age 13. But those seeds of salvation, those seeds of Christ fell amongst the briars and the weeds. And they didn't die, but they were choked. So I didn't know it, but God was going to step in. And there's an old adage from the farm days that said, if you want to get a mule's attention, you hit him in the head with a 2x4. Well, this is part one of 3 2x4s. Yes, I'm a mule. I got it. And Linda would definitely corroborate that. So anyway. Okay. I call this lesson, "There But for the Grace of God Go I." So 48 years ago, when I was young, a buddy of mine and I had just escaped from the prison, the high school confinement of our junior year. And we were having a great time. We were avid bikers. I was working in a pro bike shop as head mechanic. We're selling pro bikes that cost more than cars all over the country. And we sponsored races, et cetera, but we were into the biking. And so my buddy and I, we were out biking, and we were living in the flatlands of Ohio. And of course, we were unhappy, being 17 and knowing everything there is, we decided that it was time to have an adventure. So we got together and we schemed a little bit, and we decided that we wanted to bike Estes, Colorado. We wanted to be on the Rockies. We wanted to have some real hills. So we both had worked since we were about 10, 11 years of age. We had money. We could pay for the trip, with one exception. Neither one of us owned a car that could get out of the county, let alone to Colorado. So, being 17, I did what any 17-year-old boy would do. He went to his dad. And I laid out the plan, and my dad said, yes. I almost fell over. And after raising three kids, what was in his mind? And a little context for younger people here. In my day, which understandably my kids said I named dirt, I'm old, but there's no such thing as a cell phone. There was no such thing as GPS. There was no such thing as texting. There was basically, if you hit the road, you were on your own. And we were going to be gone for 10 days on our first adventure outside of the homestead. And he said, yes. So, okay. So with that, we packed up our gear, packed up the car, pointed the nose of the thing west. We had a Rand McNally road atlas. That was it. We would not be in contact, because the only way to call was with a payphone, which means you take about 4 hours worth of pay to make a 3-minute call. That wasn't going to happen. So anyway, we jump in, we go. The trip out was uneventful. We stayed at some nondescript campground along the way, but all of a sudden we find ourselves in Denver. And we knew where we wanted to go, State Route 34, so which is northwest of Denver. So we miraculously got through Denver, and up on 34. 34 goes through Estes Park, so that was kind of the connection. State Route 34 follows the Big Thompson River. So we cruise on up, we get past little town of Drake, and just beyond that was a campground called the Seven Pines. They had a campground for tents, or a camping spot for tents. It was down on the river, all the way to the west. There was no one further west from us. It was a beautiful spot. We were making fun of the Big Thompson River. It sounds mighty, like the mighty Mississippi. It was actually about 8 feet across and 6 inches deep. We had creeks bigger than that in Ohio. So anyway, but it was crystal clear water. You could see the fish swimming. It was beautiful. The trees. You know, we're from the flatlands. All of a sudden we have mountains. It's great. So we're having a good time. We're hiking, we're biking, we're fishing. One day we went up to Estes Park and we spent the entire day riding Estes Park. We came back, more biking, more hiking, fishing, etc. And then one day we decided we wanted to take a real challenge. So we're up altitude of about 6,100 feet. We wanted to ride down to Loveland. Now, we knew everything, but we knew nothing. We didn't realize Loveland was at 5,000 feet. So we had a roughly 1,100-foot differential in 20 miles. So we jump on our bikes, and we shoot down to Loveland. We made it in 40 minutes, 45 minutes. We were passing cars. We couldn't go any faster. The problem with going down, you got to come back up. That was bad enough. The other problem is we trained at 800 feet above sea level. We're at 6,100 to 5,000 feet. It's a good thing we're young, dumb, and stupid, because at this age, it would kill me. It took us 4.5 hours to get back, and we never sat in our saddles. We could not gasp enough air. So there was a learning. God was teaching us a little something there. So fast forward to Friday. The date was July 31st, 1976. This is the main event. This is where God's 2x4 was going to be applied. Without question. So the day went really well. At 5 o'clock, it started clouding up. And it started to rain. So we moved the bikes, camera gear, duffel bags, anything that was possibly damaged by water, we moved it into the car. The tent, all of our camping gear, sleeping bags, all the stuff we just bought for the trip was sitting by the river. That was fine. We jump in the car. 7 o'clock, it really starts to rain. And we're listening to the Loveland radio station, to the music. Nothing's going on. We just figured it's a Colorado rainstorm. So we're there. The rain's hitting the top of the car, and it's lulling us to sleep, and we are out. At some point later, I jolted awake. It was God. It wasn't me. I popped out of it, and it didn't sound right. There was something wrong. It didn't feel right. There was something wrong. I hit the lights. The nose of the car was facing the river. The lights were underwater. It was a good thing it was a stick shift car. So I put the thing in. I started the engine. It started. Tim got an elbow to the ribs. He was now awake. I backed up into the lane, heading up to State Route 34, which was considerably higher elevation than where we were, right at the river. The problem was, as we were progressing up the lane went down before it progressed in its ascent. I stalled the engine. Now, this is back in the day when the cars had not been made so safe we can't do anything with them. So I knew how to run the thing. I threw it in first gear. Tim jumped out, pushed the car to the front wheels, it was front wheel drive, hit the upslope, and I used a starter, an electric car then, and it pulled it up onto State Route 34, so we got the car out of the drink. we parked the car near a school bus that had been painted green. It was apparently someone's conversion of a camper in the day. That camper, that school bus, was providential, as I'll tell you in a few minutes. We ran into the campground office where the owner of the campground was checking his logs and trying to account for everyone in the campground. We were told there were two young ladies on the north side of the river, across from where we were. We were on the south side. Across the river, they had several cabins, and they had rented one of these cabins and were staying in it. They were outside the cabin screaming. The men in the camp were trying to gather up their kids and everything. They were trying to get the ladies to come across. They wouldn't do it. So Tim and I just said, we'll go get them. You know, we were in shape. It may not be very gracious, but they're coming back. And so we took off. By this time, the river had swollen from its nice little 8-foot creek to roughly 80 to 100 feet across. So Tim and I took off across the water. It was about knee deep, flowing fairly well. We got to about the middle of the stream, and we were passing what was the parking spaces for the cabins. And there were a couple cars there and a cluster of trees, 5 trees. We got to the middle of it. The ladies were still not obeying, or we weren't there yet. We needed a couple more minutes. We got right to that center area of the parking lot, and I heard it. It was a freight train. I look up, and there's a 20-foot wall of water descending on us. I grabbed it was a Cadillac, of all things, sitting there. I grabbed it. I grabbed Tim. Tim grabbed the car, and we hunkered down as we got hammered with ice water. This was melt from upper elevations. We jumped on top of the Cadillac. If you've ever been on a car or messed with a car that's got it's well waxed and wet, it's like being on ice. We were sliding around trying to hang on for our dear lives. The water now was about 4 feet high and moving faster. The initial surge was like a storm surge, and now what was coming behind it. The Cadillac started to float. It floated, it backed into an AMC Pacer. It was parked behind it with a roof rack. That's better than trying to hang on to the Cadillac. We were now on the top of the Cadillac. The Cadillac hit the Pacer, did a 180, and floated downstream to destruction. The Pacer started to float. We knew where it was going. It was going to follow the Cadillac. From there, we jumped off. There was a large bush right next to the Pacer. So, no choice. We jumped into the bush. What we didn't realize, it was a Colorado thorn bush. 1.5 to 2-inch spikes, and they grow in clusters. I was wearing cutoff jeans, shorts, and a t-shirt, and tennis shoes. Tim was at least bright enough to have long pants on. But needless to say, it shredded my shorts, my shirt, and me. And I have needles where nobody wants needles. On the positive side, though, the water was ice water. It was numbing everything. You could hardly feel your hands, your legs. Name the part. You were cold. And the the cold water constricted the blood vessels and helped stop the bleeding. So that, and that was a blessing. The bush, however, having no root system, started to wash away. So now we're headed for our fourth jump. The water now is 5-6 feet deep, running probably 15 to 20 knots. So we both jumped in to one of the five pine trees. It was the smallest one of the group. And we needed no, at that point, we needed no encouragement. It was hand over hand, legs, we didn't care. We climbed up 20 feet in that tree. We went as far up as we possibly could until the branches started getting dangerously thin. The last thing we wanted to do is ride it down into the drink. So Tim was above me. I parked at about 20 feet facing the trunk of the tree. And I clung to that tree. At one point, my feet were in the water. I'll tell you this, more prayers were offered up in the ensuing 4 hours than had been offered up my entire lifetime. The rain, lightning, and deafening thunder, which was so loud it shook the trees, was continuous. It was like a strobe. The lightning was like a strobe. It was constant. And being in a 70s discotheque or whatever, it was constant, like there's five or six strobes going at the same time. The thunder met every one of those flashes. And it was so loud you could barely hear it. So much power, so much energy. From our perch, the lightning, the strobe-like lightning, produced the surreal world of massive devastation. Rushing downstream before us, people, cars, houses, animals, trees. Moving by now, it was at least 20 knots, 25 knots. It was amazing. We were in a war zone with propane tanks floating down the river too. They're striking rocks and exploding, and we could hear the shrapnel going all around us. There was no not seeing it, and I clung to that tree. Putting this into words is very what we felt and what I felt and what I saw in from my perch in that tree has been extremely difficult. It's been 48 years and I still can't really get my hands around it. But there's a quote from Edgar Allan Poe's short story, A Descent into the Maelstrom, meaning whirlpool, about a fisherman that rode his boat into the bottom of a whirlpool. And the first quote is this: "Never shall I forget the sensation of awe, horror, and admiration with which I gazed about me." And it's a mixed feeling, because you're watching the devastation, lives, people, cars, everything being destroyed, I mean, ultimately destroyed around you, and you're in awe of the power, of God's power. I'm incapable of putting this into words. Two of the larger trees out of the cluster fell into the river. One of them hit our tree, causing it to list downstream. And anyone who's ever been on a man lift or an articulated lift that gets bumped, moving 3 inches is a shorts change, let alone when you're listing 15 degrees now at the top of a tree, ready to go into the drink. For a moment, I thought we were going down. But then again, not really. It dawned on me at that moment that God had his hands on us, because we would never would have made those four jumps without his help. And regardless of the outcome, all is well. there are some other feelings I've had trouble expressing over the years. And again, a quote from Poe's Old Man in the same short story. Quote, "It may look like boasting, but what I tell you is truth. I began to reflect on how magnificent a thing it was to die in such a manner, and how foolish it was in me to think so paltry a consideration is my own individual life, in view of so wonderful a manifestation of God's power." Our tree held. God's grace, and I clung to the tree. As the night wore on, the rain, thunder, water level, and velocity started to diminish. The men in the camp had located us in our tree and had tried for some time to form a human chain to get to us, but the river overwhelmed them every time. So sometime after midnight, 1 a.m., somewhere in there, they were able to reach us and help get us down. Tired, frozen solid, stiff, exhausted, we went to the car and we grabbed our duffel bags, which had happened providentially to be thrown in the back deck window, and they were dry. The bus mentioned earlier had been converted into a triage center. The bus, painted green and labeled the Jolly Green Giant, was owned by a farm family from Minnesota. They had six kids too. And it arrived at the camp just as the storm hit. The men, God's grace again, that bus saved our lives the second time. The men also located one of the young ladies Tim and I attempted to retrieve. She had been swept downstream and managed to cling to the riverside. She had spent most of the time, those 4 hours, half in and half out of the ice water. When they found her, she was losing consciousness, and one of the men did a diving save to keep her from being swept away. By the time we boarded the bus, the women, they'd thrown her into the upper bunk behind the driver's side, but behind the driver's seat. And you have to realize in a triage, and you first responders know this, there's no bashfulness. You do what's got to be done, and you do it right away. Well, they had her clothes off. They were using hot compresses to try to get heat back into her. She was having trouble breathing. What strikes me, though, the shock when I saw her, she was blue. How she was still alive, to this day, I have no idea. They ushered us to the back of the bus for the same treatment, wet clothes off. We started getting some dry, got dried off, and then started putting our dry clothes back on. The men handed us needle-nose pliers to extract the needles, which I didn't care at that point. Let's get them out. We were given something to eat and to drink. Exhausted, we picked bunks for the balance of the night. The next day, dawn broke with clear blue skies, a gentle breeze, cool mountain air, all belying the maelstrom and destruction of the night before. Up early as we always were, we ventured out and started surveying the damage. Our car, miraculously, during the panic exit, had ended up parked on State Route 34 on the highest ground in the area, higher than even the bus. And we were told the water level came up to the second stop of that bus before it receded. It almost took the bus out. Most of the campground vehicles were totally destroyed. The location of our campsite was still underwater, and obviously there was no evidence of our camping gear whatsoever. It had long since made its way down to Loveland. We retraced our paths to the remain of our cluster of trees in the former location of the cabin where the young ladies had been. The cabin was gone, and we started to explore downstream. Then we found her. An image indelibly burned into my mind. The Big Thompson River meanders on its way to join the South Platte River near Greenlee, Colorado. Approximately 100 yards downstream from the cabin's former location, the river turns 90 degrees south. There, on the north bank of the Big Thompson River Canyon, laying face down on what had been the cabin's gable end wall, with arms splayed out above her head, head facing east, the bright morning sun reflecting off her golden hair, flowing down her back as if someone had just brushed it smooth, was the lifeless body of the second young lady we'd attempted to retrieve. The cabin truss system, roof, still intact, laying across her lower back. Her name was Tenna. The aftermath. By mid-morning, the National Guard was on site. State Route 34 was destroyed upstream and downstream, sheer cliffs, no exit by road. The Guard informed us that any vehicle that would not start would be scrapped. And for us, that meant our bikes, my camera, everything. So I did whatever any foolish 17-year-old would do. I found the jack and jacked the front of the car up on silt. I borrowed some tools and crawled underneath and dropped the starter. Got the starter out, pulled it apart, and got about 2 cups of water out of it. Dried it off, let it dry in the sun, put it back in, hit the ignition, and the thing turned. I proved to the National Guard the car started, so they tagged it as such, because they were all have to be flown out by Chinook choppers. The Guard was then starting to evacuate survivors via helicopter and had brought in needed supplies for the survivors. In the end, over 800 people were flown out by helicopter from that space. But in our case, being able-bodied, a guide was dropped off, and we were going to take a 2+ hour hike over the mountains to get out. We spent the afternoon hiking out, and we met a retired couple from Denver, George and Peggy Coyle, were among our group. We were hauling out in our duffel bags some of their personal belongings. They had lost their camper van in the flood. It was totally destroyed, right down to the chassis. They offered for us to go to their home and stay with them until we can make arrangements to get home. When we got to their house, we were able to call our families and tell them that we were still alive. And it had been the first they'd heard us from us in a week. Our parents made arrangements and sent us Amtrak tickets, and we rode the Amtrak back to Ohio. So what had happened? On July 31st, 76, a mass of warm, moist air, unstable air, was trapped behind a polar air mass that was west of Estes Park, up in the Rocky Mountain National Park area. This area can be described as the mouth of the funnel. Where we were in the canyon was the neck. Upper winds, atmospheric winds, had moved in behind the warm air mass and trapped it against the polar air mass. And when warm, moist air meets cold air, it can only do one thing. It's going to dump its load, and it sure did. Over 4 hours, 12 to 14 inches fell on the Big Thompson River region. That's more than a normal annual rainfall. And it triggered a flood crest that reached 30 feet high and a velocity of 15 to 24 miles an hour as it raced through the canyon. At the peak of the deluge, rain fell at the rate of 7.5 inches an hour. There had been no warning. The flash flood warning came from the National Weather Service at 2300 Central Standard Time, several hours after the crest had passed. Bodies were swept as far east as State Route 25, 25 miles downstream. 144 people died in the flood. Five others have never been found. There are over 250 injured. 438 autos were destroyed. 418 homes were destroyed. 152 businesses were destroyed. The young ladies, Tenna, born September 13, 1956, died July 31, 1976, age 19. She had grown up in a small town in the eastern side of Colorado. Sandy, the blue lady, was 18. She survived. Both were fresh graduates from high school, graduating class about 25. They were celebrating a new stage in their lives, looking forward to moving on. They had grown up together, living next door to each one another in the small town. The two were best of friends and inseparable. Sandy took the loss of Tenna very hard, and I found this because I wrote her after we were home. I didn't hear back, and about 3 months later, her mother sent a very gracious letter. Sandy was having a lot of problems losing Tenna. And the mother asked, she didn't want to talk about it, she didn't want to talk to anyone about it, and so she asked very politely not to contact, and I have honored that for 48 years. There's another nod to first responders here that I have to say. As Tim and I were on our way to cross the river to go after the young ladies, a Colorado State Highway Patrolman pulled up, warning us of all that was going on. It was the only warning that anyone received. He left our camp and headed downstream to another small town, to Drake, which is just a few miles down the road. And he was stopping traffic. He was using his PA to warn people to get out of the way. He's credited with saving hundreds of lives that night. But when that crest hit us in the tree, it made its way down to Drake, and it swept Patrolman Willis Hugh Purdy, 26 years on the force, into the Big Thompson River, along with his cruiser. It's been immortalized, his efforts and his bravery have been immortalized by a song by Chuck Pyle called Here Comes the Water. Okay, the takeaways. God's mercy through Jesus Christ. I have no earthly reason to have survived. It's well known that if you're midstream in that torrent, you're dead. There is no escaping. Rivers will pull you to midstream. God's grace, mercy, and hands were clearly visible in my deliverance from death. Nothing I did. The waking up in the car is just a critical moment. If it had been 5 minutes later, we would have been downstream. our crossing near the Carr's Bush tree cluster when the deluge struck. If we had been 5 feet further away from that Cadillac, we'd been gone. There was no getting to it. The tree, the smallest of the group, standing throughout the maelstrom. How can that be? Conifers have no root system. The bigger trees have better root systems. They don't have a tap root, but they're wider. This little tree held. The Jolly Green Giant arriving when it did. Providential. The clear message here: your life is not your own. It is by the grace of God through Jesus Christ only that I have life. Without Christ, I deserve death for my sins, and this life can end in a second. The Big Thompson River was my Jordan. The Jordan River is described as the descender or the downcomer. A fast-flung river, it meanders some 200 miles from its source to destination, a linear distance of 65 miles. At some points, the Jordan is 688 feet below sea level and descends at a rate of 9 feet per mile, terminating in the Dead Sea, where nothing lives and there's no way out. The Jordan River is a symbol of death. The Israelites crossed over at spring flood stage, where the river with doubles in size from about 100 feet to 200 feet. That's why they're terrified of it. One could easily be swept from the riverbank by just putting their feet in it, and that's what Gary covered last week, the crossing over. The Israelites were terrified. Joshua had to calm them down and get them to do this. The Israelites had the Ark of the Covenant, God, midstream to protect them, and they crossed over safely from death into life. Tim and I, had the providential Carr's Bush and tree. If we hadn't passed near them, or without them, we wouldn't be here. But God delivered us. To God be the glory. It took some time after returning home to start processing any of what I've just told you. As a matter of fact, it's taken 48 years. My senior year of high school was a blur. I don't remember much of anything, as is most of my freshman year in college. Life returned to normal, but it really didn't. Life changed. You can't get hit that hard upside the head with a 2x4 and not be changed. To this day, I don't fully comprehend what happened or why. Why did Tim and I survive? Why wasn't the death toll 145 or 146? Why were we spared when Tenna and all the others were not? I have no answers except it was by the grace of God. The tree upon which we were delivered in that river is a type of tree, the cross of Christ being the antitype, which is what I should have been clinging to all along. Nevertheless, to my shame, I still wasn't fully listening or paying attention. Life returned to normal, but not quite normal, but I still went about my own way of doing things, though the cracks in my way were definitely showing. The mule in me again. God was after me. What I've just related to you is the first of three major corrections or attitude adjustments that I've had in my life. There were more applications of the 2x4 coming. This was an external attempt on my life. The next one would come from inside. And the third one would be a spiritual assault. Stay tuned. Always cling to the tree.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's message. If you want further information about Grace Community Church, you can visit us at gccofalliance.org. Also note, the video for this message, for this sermon, is linked in the details below. Have a great day.